You've tasted the murder hornet?
Oh, yeah. The murder hornets themselves are wild looking, but they just taste like popcorn without butter.
I'm your host, Adam Met, and today we're talking about the future of food with Eugene Wang and Bill Broadbent. Up first, Eugene is the founder and CEO of Sophie's Bionutrients. We chat about microalgae protein, data, and why plant-based is the new vegetarian. Then, later on, I chat with Bill about the many benefits of insect consumption. The food industry from start to finish has many practices that are harmful to people and the world. We can envision a future where everything from food production to transportation to sales are all done safer, cleaner, and more sustainably. A quick reminder that we're planting a tree for every person who subscribes to this podcast, so make sure to hit that subscribe button. And up first, we have Eugene Wang on Planet Reimagined. So Eugene, if we keep going business as usual, eating the same types of food that we're eating right now, can you paint a picture of what the Earth would look like in the next 10, 20 years or so?
Well, you're gonna see, number one is that animal protein is not going to go away. Animal food is not going to go away. But it's gonna be number one. The clean ones are going to be extremely pricey. So pricey that only the rich, maybe the 20%, can afford that kind of pricey meat. And then the rest have to eat the extremely unhealthy, unclean meat or seafood. Because why? It's just we run out of space, we run out of a safer way to grow those animals. And so you ended up having to settle for something, you know, second best or lousy that, you know, a lot of these unclean meat will have to circulate. That's number one. And talking about agriculture, talking about plants, even going forward is not going to be sustainable, in my opinion. Even the basic wheat, they're encountering a lot of problem because of the global warming, because of the deforestation is so much. And think about it, you know, going forward 20, 30, even 100 years, we're going to run out of proper space for our agriculture. So even agriculture, the plants will become pricey as well. And What about the poor people? What about mom and pop? What are they going to eat?
Right. So you work with something called microalgae. At right. The most basic level, can you explain what that is?
So in our vision is that going forward into the future, the world of food and nutrition will, should I say, 80% or even 90% coming from what we call bioreactors. What is bioreactors? You know, you look at what we're developing today, the cell-based meat, the cultured meat, a lot of the single-cell protein meat alternative like corn, and even like the microalgae protein we're developing are all happening in that bioreactor. So the microalgae protein that we're developing is this basic idea, is that people are eating microalgae for nutrition for a very, very long time. And a lot of people know that microalgae is so nutritious, so superfood. It is good for the health of a human body, especially a lot of the vegans and vegetarians. I think you know this better than I do, is that they actually use a lot of microalgae as a supplement to their nutrition. So then along the way I was doing Sophie's Kitchen the last 10 years, a lot of my consumers asked this question. So you're making plant-based seafood. So do your products have equivalent nutritional value like the real seafood? Well, the answer is no, unfortunately, because we're using potato starch, pea protein, and a Japanese yam to make it. So it's hard to have equivalent nutritional value. And that got me thinking. I was thinking like, hey, fishes and shrimp, they ate algae to get their nutrient. Why can't we use that directly to make food? And so that's how I started to look into the way to see if we can make microalgae, a very tiny, fast-growing single-cell organism, and make it as a protein source to make our food. So in a nutshell, microalgae protein is just a very single creature that we try to leverage to make it into a protein source and extract the protein from it to make burgers and even plant milk. That's the idea.
What's the difference in terms of the carbon footprint of microalgae as compared to something like beef?
Oh, tremendously. Let me give you one example, very simple example. Growing our algae from the way you started propagation till the day you harvest it, till you extract it into protein and make it into burger, from the start to the end, it's less than a week. We can do it in 7 days.
Wow.
Where beef, the cattle was born all the way to it was slaughtered and make into burger, it takes the current supply chain more than 2 years to be on the shelf. And not to mention, because the long period of time, the water you need, the farms they generated, and then because all these cattle are raised on a farm that's far away from the urban city because they're so smelly, right? So that's why they have to ship it into the downtown for people to consume. Where in our case, our bioreactor can, it's just like a microbrewery. I can set it up right in the downtown of Chicago or New York. You see what I'm saying? And it doesn't really occupy a lot of footprint. Like the one we're setting up right here in Singapore, it's less than 5,000 square feet. And I can set up to 20,000 liter tank, you know? And so that's the kind of efficiency we're talking about. So talking about the carbon footprint, oh man, you know, these bioreactor operation is super efficient and super helpful to cut down the carbon footprint.
That's great. And I've seen that there are so many other uses for this microalgae in addition to food. Can you talk through a few of the other uses for it? Because that sounds incredible.
Yeah. So we all know that microalgae has wonderful protein. But remember
now we do, thanks to you.
Okay. But I guess you're right. Yeah. Microalgae actually started out with the lipid, which is a lot of the biofuel projects was starting back in, I think, 70 or 80s. And there are still some biofuel projects ongoing. But as we all see now today, fossil fuel is just like, it looks like endless, number one. And number two is that you never know how much we still have under our feet. And then number three is that, well, so many vehicles and cars are moving away to renewable energy. The kind of fuel burning operation or machines is going to be like dinosaur going forward, in my opinion. So biofuel project is pretty much not so hopeful. But think about the lipid it has. It's a wonderful cooking oil. Well, when we are dealing with the palm plantation problems, especially here in Southeast Asia, you know, I think microalgae present a wonderful solution. You can grow the cooking oil with all the bioreactors. Then you don't need the deforestation. And on top of that, the oil is really healthy and delicious. It has saturated fat or unsaturated, I forgot which one is healthy. And what's even more is that, I don't know if you know, there are an estimated 300,000 to a million different kind of species of microalgae. There is only one type of palm. So think about it. We can use this kind of advantage to grow a lot of different kinds of cooking oil and even different kind of protein. And not just cooking oil, not just protein, it also has wonderful carbohydrate. And you can use that to make into starch. So say, for example, someday if wheat, the flour that we use becomes too expensive, we can use microalgae to make starch, so that we can continue on to eat our bakery or noodles or pasta without paying too much. So that's what we envision for the future.
That's amazing. And all of that sounds so incredible, but the next step is you need to convince people to eat something that's called microalgae. So how do you plan to do that?
That's a wonderful question. Just a few years ago, there's another company out of San Francisco. They kind of stumbled on that. They failed to gauge the consumer feedback properly. So we're doing three things. So number one is that we are extracting the nutrition out of the microalgae. A lot of the microalgae companies, they just sell you the dry biomass without any processing. So the difference between the two strategies is that because once we extract the protein out of microalgae, it becomes the pure protein flour. And so that functioning just like any of the soy protein flour you have from the marketplace. And then by doing so, it reduced the risk of any kind of allergy and any kind of stomach pain problems, number one. Number two, what we're doing is that we're going to do a lot of consumer sensory testing. What kind of changes they want to see with this flour or with that oil, you know, that's what we're going to do. And last but not least is a lot of marketing campaign, PR campaign to raise the awareness of this thing, you know, because obviously I'm pretty sure a lot of consumers know what chlorella, what spirulina is. So it shouldn't be too difficult for them to understand that this can be also made into foods. And once you properly promote it, I think they will embrace it.
Yeah, the biggest things for me, obviously, and I think for most people, are flavor and texture. And so exactly. How does that work with a plant-based algae?
So algae actually presents a very umami flavor, believe it or not. It was so pleasant. I like the flavor because it's a little bit oceany. It's very mild. The kind of savory is not too salty, not too sweet, kind of in between. The texture is something you have to use your food science knowledge to make it happen. So say, for example, what we're doing right now is that we're trying to put it into extruder machine to denature the protein so that it will have this meat-like texture. And once that's done, you then can make it into everything you see today with the plant meat, is that you can make it into chicken nugget, burger, pulled pork, fish fillet, whatever. But actually the key thing for consumer is actually the color. So if you remember a lot of spirulina and chlorella you have, when you get it, wow, it's really dark. Dark green, dark brown. That's not going well with food manufacturing, I have to tell you. And so the advantage of our technology is that because we grow it in the bioreactor, and so it's totally dark. And so the microalgae becomes a lot lighter and gives you that pleasant color that you don't have to use any chemical to remove the color. The microalgae sold in the supplement section, you have to use a lot of Frankenstein crazy chemical to remove the color so that consumer will accept it. But in our case, we developed this wonderful technology that we don't need to do any crazy thing.
That's funny because I grew up vegan and color was never something that was incredibly important to me. Because I grew up with brands like Boca and Veet. And I don't know if you know those brands, but it's funny, I don't see them in the supermarket anymore. And they weren't such big crazes 15, 20 years ago. But now you see Beyond Meat and Impossible Burger, they are just absolutely everywhere. Right. What do you think changed from 15, 20 years ago to today?
Good question. The biggest change is that 15, 20 years ago, the majority of the consumers are people who are, like myself, vegetarians or vegans. And according to all the research, that part of the population in the US especially is very steady, only 5%. Not a lot. So that's 15, 20 years ago. So that's why the products are always called vegans or vegetarian that. Now today, they use the words plant-based, which is smart. Once they use the word plant-based, not only it makes this phenomenon sound trendy, number one, and number two is that, you know, when you are shopping vegan and vegetarian, you kind of have this tension or nervousness that, you know, oh, people will think I'm a vegan or vegetarian. You know, once you're labeled as vegan and vegetarian, people kind of are expecting you, oh, none of your life or your things can be animal made or animal origin. Like your wallet should be, you know, synthetic and so on and so forth. So 15, 20 years ago, vegan and vegetarian, these two words are so formal, so official that it almost like if you want to eat this, you have to make a statement. And now companies are telling the consumers that, oh, it's okay, don't worry about it. You can be casual vegan, casual vegetarian, and just eating it from time to time. you don't have to eat it every day. So that's what the beauty about this is, that that's why it becomes so mainstream today. A lot of flexitarians are eating it. And that's why all the older brands are kind of losing their market share.
Yeah, I mean, Meatless Monday has become such a big thing where people go vegan or vegetarian just for one day of the week. And I was running some of the numbers. The amount of CO2 that would prevent from going into the atmosphere just from people, especially in the Western world, not eating meat just one day a week is enormous. But something that you kind of research and talk about is the use of data with microalgae. And that's something that I love to talk about on this podcast with some other guests. But what is the relationship there between data and microalgae?
The idea basically is that, you know, since we have anywhere from 300,000 to 1 million different species of microalgae in the world, in the water, what's going to happen into the future, as I can foresee, is that you may need to use a lot of extreme condition to grow our food and nutrition. These extreme condition, let me give you one example, is that there is a project we're going to do in Dubai. And as you know, in Dubai, the fresh water is very precious. So they're forced to use brackish water or seawater to grow nutrition. They're forced to use highly salinated soil to grow food. So if we imagine, if we have a big library, big data bank of these different strains of microalgae, I can then select a strain of microalgae that is able to accommodate the brackish water, which is not really seawater, but not really fresh water. And then at the same time, this strain of microalgae can grow well with a lot of the wonderful protein or oil that we need. So imagine that, you know. So right now, we only have about 5 or 6 strains that we're playing with. So it's not enough. The data we have is not enough for that kind of purpose. So once we have enough data, I can find out 1 or 2 strains that can grow well in places like Dubai. I can even find 1 or 2 strains that have this anti-freezing capability we can grow in Alaska or even the Antarctica, you know? And so that's the beauty of this library database, is that, you know, you can use the data you have to search and to find the best strain of microalgae to do the job that you're thinking of to do in the future, you know? So that's what I think is important.
What an incredible thing to think about, that we could grow a large portion of our food in a place like Antarctica, where it's not taking up space where we would normally live. That sounds amazing. We can, you know, regrow the entire rainforest.
Yeah, that's the beauty of this research, is that, you know, I really think in a way we kind of overlook these tiny little single cell or multi-cell creatures for so many years, because microalgae, I don't know if you know, the latest fossil record confirmed that it's the mother of all the plants. So all the plants in the world today, they are the descendants of the very ancient microalgae. And if that's the origin of whatever things happening, why we human being not using it as our direct source of nutrition? Not only they have abundant of nutrition, they are really fast growing. They are really sturdy. You can grow it in a lot of very different extreme condition if you find the right strain.
Right.
So Elon Musk want to go to Mars. He has this beautiful rocket. He has astronauts. But what about food? Is he going to do the Matt Damon crazy potato 10 thing on Mars? I think no. I think he should talk to me, you know? We have this wonderful idea. We can match up our database right here on Earth and see if we can find identical strain on Mars and just grow the microalgae or whatever single cell creature you can find on Mars in the open. And you, voila, you have your sustainable food on the other planets. That's the kind of extension of this wonderful project that can become, in my opinion.
Elon, you heard it here on Planet Reimagined. Contact Eugene. He knows how to fix your food problem when getting people into space.
Thank you.
So you've been the founder and you've run two companies. One is called Sophie's Kitchen and one is called Sophie's Bionutrients. First and foremost, who is Sophie?
Well, Sophie is actually my daughter, my eldest daughter. So she is allergic to shellfish. Starting from my grandma and grandpa, they make vegetarian foods as street vendors in Taiwan. And then my father set up a factory for the family business. So when I found out my daughter is allergic to shellfish, so I use a lot of the thing that we make in the factory to nimble some plant-based shrimp for her to eat. And then one day I had this friend coming over from New York, saw me doing that. He said, "Hey, Eugene, you always want to start a business, right? This could be an idea." I was like, voila, that's a wonderful idea. So that's how back in 2010, I started Sophie's Kitchen in the States. And then like I told you, along the way, I got so many consumers asking about the nutrition. So that's why 6 years ago, I started studying about this microalgae. And then along the way, I got a lot of support, surprisingly, from here in Singapore, from the government in Singapore. And so that's why we started this food tech project here in Singapore. And then all of a sudden we realized we got this B2C consumer brand business, Sophie's Kitchen in California, and this B2B part of Sophie's Bionutrient here in Singapore. So that's why we decided to separate the operation totally and become two independent units.
So Sophie's Kitchen is focused on plant-based seafood.
Right.
Have you thought at all about overfishing and how by the production of plant-based seafood, that is going to help offset any overfishing issues?
That was my initial mission when I started Sophie's Kitchen, is that I'm hoping that we can solve the overfishing problem by starting Sophie's Kitchen. I think I was dreaming. I don't think this is going to happen. Why? Because people throughout the world today, especially even in the Western markets, like places like US, Europe, Australia, even, seafood is a healthy food item to a lot of people. And it's hard for people to understand and imagine how polluted our water today is. It's all thanks to our industrialization. So the water today, we're seeing multiple times of heavy metal measure compared to 20, 30 years ago. We're seeing multiple times of plastic microbes in the water compared to 20, 30 years ago. We're seeing warming water, so you're not even sure how nutritious the fishes are today compared to 20, 30 years ago, because a lot of these fishes are deep water fish and they love colder temperature. And so those are the issues with the seafood supply today. So the problem is that they think seafood is healthy because of all the nutrients. And the fishes, the shrimp, all the seafood, they get their nutrients from the algae in reality. So that's why we're initiating this microalgae project, is because that we want to use microalgae as the true replacement down the road for seafood. Number one, it's more efficient. Number two, it's less polluted. Number three is that you avoid all the ethical issues, all the environmental issues. And so that's what I think the world should work on, is that, you know, try to make things more efficiently. Doesn't mean you're cutting the cost down. Efficiency really is not just about numbers. Efficiency is in every aspect of your operations. We want to develop something to help people to make that efficiency happen.
And yeah. What's your next step now for either of the companies?
So I'm not managing Sophie's Kitchen business anymore, to be honest with you. Miles Woodruff is our new CEO. So he's taking charge of the company right now. I'm wishing him doing well with the business. And I, from what I heard, it is. But here with Sophie's Bionutrients, we hope to become a microalgae specialist, especially microalgae for food. But going forward, we're hoping to use microalgae to make cooking oil, like I mentioned to you as well. Is that because palm oil is existing in any kind of food that you have today? And I think that is not quite right. Someone had to come up with some solution for this problem. And so after we tackle the protein issues, we're hoping to come up with a few strains of microalgae that can grow the oil well, and that we can sell this type of microalgae oil to the market at a very affordable cost. And down the road, I'm hoping that even we can sell to all the food manufacturers, the MNCs like, you know, Nestle, General Mills, PepsiCo, you name it, you know, to become our customers. So the future is really grandeur in our planning.
So to kind of wrap up, for everybody who's listening, if you had to recommend the first thing that they should try that's made from microalgae, what is that kind of gateway food?
So there are two things we're working on right now. One is a microalgae patty, which is identical to our signature Southeast Kitchen crab cakes. So we're possibly going to make that available to Southeast Kitchen pretty soon. It has this wonderful essential amino acids, wonderful vitamin B12 that's missing in a lot of the plant-based protein. That's number one. Number two thing we're working on is a microalgae protein drink. So this protein drink can be reformulated into plant milk or any kind of protein energy drink.
Amazing. Well, Eugene, I've learned so much from you. I'm sure everybody has learned so much. And I know that everyone is going to want to go try this incredible superfood that you've helped to develop. So thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me. Thank you.
Now we switch over to Bill Broadbent. He's the president of EntoSense, and his goal is to make insects part of our daily diet. I intentionally ask him some of the same questions, and it's interesting to hear their two different perspectives. Without further ado, here is Bill Broadbent on Planet Reimagined. So, Bill, if we keep going with business as usual, eating the same types and amounts of food that we're doing now, could you paint a picture of what the planet might look like in 10, 15, 20 years?
Yeah, actually, that's one of the things that has me concerned and started me on this path is that I realized that by the time my kids are my age, there's going to be half again as many people on the planet. And right now, meat production is already having trouble. It's the number one cause of deforestation. You know, it's a big cause of pollution, things like that. And as our population increases, meat production will have to increase, and it's just basically impossible. So we need some other place to get that type of protein. And insects are a natural. Insects are a real animal protein, all nine essential amino acids. So the more I looked into it, the more that seemed like one of the answers.
So at a kind of high level, what is entomophagy?
So in a simple sense, entomophagy is anybody that eats bugs on a regular basis. You're an entomophagist, which is great because people normally, you say you're an entomophagist, they think you have a degree. But yeah, pretty simple to become an entomophagist. And I say that, but it's amazing how hard it is for us here in the States, especially Europe, Australia, how hard it is for us to break that, what I call an unwarranted cultural fear, and actually eat insects, even though people, Mexico, 200 different insects they eat. You know, chapulinas are one of my favorites, and they're spicy grasshoppers, or spiced grasshoppers, not always spicy. And they taste fantastic. You know, I joke that the hardest bug to eat is the first bug. But after that, it's kind of interesting to watch yourself, you know, evolve. I look at dishes now with, I just saw a silkworm pupae soup. Sounds terrible to most people, but it looked delicious and I have no problem eating it now. So you kind of, you know, it's a mental challenge and we just happen to be wimps. You know, a lot of us just can't get past that point. But like I said, you know, once you try, all of a sudden you realize 2,000 different insects, every one of them tastes different. I joke it's the greatest culinary adventure of our time because it's a whole new food group.
Why are insects a more sustainable food solution than current meat production?
One of the things about insects is that, you know, they won't breed unless they're happy. And so we have to have an environment where they're healthy and they're happy. And that's relatively easy to do. Crickets are, you know, one of the easiest insects to grow. Anybody can, and you can grow them on your table scraps. So basically, crickets are grown in an environment like that. We want them to grow through their whole life because the larger they are, the more food there's going to be. And then to harvest them, they're put into a cold environment. They're frozen in a sense, but that's just like winter coming on. I mean, during the winter, crickets don't survive, their eggs do. And so this is being put into, you know, a cold environment to go into a brumation, which is like a hibernation, and then they die. And from there, they're washed and roasted. Or cooked. I mean, you know, insects are used in many different ways, just like every other food group. There's a whole food group, and we just don't pay that much attention to it.
Can you talk a little bit about kind of the water use and the land use for insects as opposed to other animals?
Yeah, well, not only are they sustainable, they use way, way less. There's some unbelievable figures on like 2,000 gallons of water for a hamburger. You know, and with crickets, they get most of their water from their food. We do generally, when you farm them, you give them water, but it's a fraction of what's used for any other livestock. As far as land goes, they can be grown vertically. And that's one of the great things. Not only can they be grown vertically in an urban environment, but people can grow them in their own homes. It's one of the few foods that's available to anybody anywhere. So you can be growing enough protein for your whole family and, you know, one of those big totes you get at, Lowe's or Home Depot.
So what is the protein comparison? So how many insects or crickets specifically would you need to eat in order to get the same amount of protein as a hamburger?
So, you know, a pound of crickets is a fair bit to eat if you wanted to, you know, and you don't normally eat a pound of beef either. But you can have cricket powder and you can add that to baked goods. You can add when have you ever had a cookie that's high protein and high in antioxidants and B12? And, you know, it's really good. So you don't have to eat a lot. As far as the protein content, naturally, they're about the same as beef, sometimes a little less. But because we're raising them, we're feeding them a high protein diet. And from that diet, they end up being higher in protein than beef. And again, they're a real animal, so they're just as bioavailable as beef.
Right. You mentioned before some of the other cultures around the world that have been eating insects for a really long time. Can you talk about a few of those and why it's such a big part of what they eat?
Yeah. When the European settlers hit the New World, they looked down upon the natives because they ate six-legged animals. And they use that as a slur. And so that's why Europe, the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, we all look down on people that eat insects. And we've made, you know, we revile insects and we revere steak. We've made steak a status symbol. And so people around the world now, especially younger people, are abandoning traditional foods because they have insects in them and they think that we would think they're gross. We're actually shaming people into giving up sustainable traditional foods. I mean, it's not a good thing. No. So we have to get over that attitude in a sense. And in making edible insects a trend here in the United States, we'll make it a trend worldwide because everybody watches what happens, you know, here in the States. And So it's important because, again, this is a food that is available to almost anybody anywhere in the world. And you can grow them in your own home and they grow on food waste. It's a perfect cycle, too. Even their frass is great fertilizer for growing more, you know, plants and that sort of thing. So frass is their poop.
How are you going to convince the U.S. and the Western world to start eating insects? From a marketing perspective, how are you going to make this happen?
So that's very, very difficult. It is tough to get people even interested. But we believe that the avenue, two different avenues, one is with chefs. People have to like the taste. And sometimes I think just trying a cricket isn't the way to do it because it's kind of like being given a lettuce leaf and saying, you know, what do you think? You're like, well, you know, crickets, one thing is people are always surprised at how good they taste. Very few people don't like the taste of crickets, but it's also very mild. But on the other hand, when you start having, you know, tacos with chapulinas or you have, you know, tenebrio pizza, which is, you know, superworms or mealworms on a pizza, you know, it's a whole different story. It tastes good. You know, you start to like it. And that's a big key. So we're trying to recruit as many chefs as possible to add insects to the menu. The second thing is we're working on reaching school kids because basically people my age are, like we say, 40 and over, and I'm 42, just joking, much older than that. People my age, just they don't need to try and eat insects. People between about 17, 18 and up to 40, they're much more open to it. And, you know, I would say we get 50 to 60% of those people. But when you get to kids, what kid won't eat a bug? I mean, come on. It's usually 80%. It's usually about 50%. Then the other 50% slowly go, well, okay, if you did it. And they do. But we get 70 to 80% of the kids will try the bugs. And not only that, very few people after they try them say they don't like them. And so now we have these little advocates running around saying, wow, bugs taste great. I mean, we make cotton candy crickets, believe it or not. Yeah, wow. Kids love cotton candy crickets.
What does that taste like?
Well, it's crickets with a cotton candy. So it's like an earthy cotton candy. But again, it tastes good. I mean, it's not one of my favorites, but I have to say it, you know, it's not so bad. Huh. Jalapeno garlic. There you go. That's a really good one.
That sounds good to me. You've tried, I'm assuming, a bunch of different insects from all around the world.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What is the weirdest insect you've ever tasted?
Oh, definitely the murder hornet.
You've tasted the murder hornet?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They're in Japan. They're a delicacy. And we had Tsukudani hornets and Tsukudani grasshoppers, which are the very young hornets soaked, marinated for 6 months. And one little bottle with maybe 20 of them in it is around $40 or $50. The murder hornets themselves are wild looking, but they just taste like popcorn without butter. There's almost no taste to them. Some of them that I don't like tarantulas, the legs really do kind of remind you of crab, but people like the thorax. And the thorax, to me, was unusual and a taste I didn't like at all. But in Thailand and China, they're, you know, a delicacy. One of my other favorites, humiles, which is actually, we call them stink bugs. They tasted like pistachio nuts. I mean, I could eat them all day long. As far as my daily favorite is two things. One, of course, is the cricket powder because I can add it to just about anything. A focus with me is the prebiotic fiber. It's very hard for us to get prebiotic fiber. The exoskeleton of crickets is a prebiotic fiber. So all these people are trying to increase their probiotics ought to think about the nutrition for probiotics, which is prebiotics. So we use the cricket powder fairly often. But if I'm going to do something kind of exotic for friends and stuff, I like to use the chapulinas because you can add them to a burrito or a taco, tostado, something like that. And they always taste good. And they can be flavored. They run from salt or lemon and salt to adobados, chipotle.
Wow. From what you're saying, it seems like the first way to get started with being an entomophagist is with cricket powder, right? Because it's the easiest thing to add to so many things.
Right. It's fun because you can add it. I mean, basically, it's a 20% cricket powder, 80% regular baking flour, and you can do anything with it you want. You can, from pizza crust to cake, cookies.
So what's the next step after cricket powder? If somebody wants to actually taste a full insect, what would be the starter insect that you would recommend?
If you're brave enough, I would go for the chapulina. Because the joke in Mexico is that gringos go down there and we're sitting in a bar drinking beer and we're eating these spicy peanuts and they're not peanuts, they're actually chapulinas. And as soon as you mention it, they stop eating them. You know, they don't even know because they just taste like, not really a peanut, but you know, you get the idea. It tastes like a nut in a sense.
Yeah. Even in the US and the other places where you ship, do some insects sell better in specific places for cultural reasons?
Oh, yeah. We sell a lot of chapulinas, you know, down south, mostly because of the Hispanic market. The Latin market isn't quite as strong, but still. And then the cricket powder is nationwide, as you can expect. We have a large Asian audience that likes the silkworm pupae. We also find that there's a lot of grandparents that just don't think this is a big deal at all. You know, they grew up eating this. They grew up, you know, and they didn't know until they got older. And they even wonder, why did it disappear? You know, you're right. We don't eat silkworm pupae anymore. You know, why not?
Yeah. This podcast and in each episode, we try and make connections between different areas of sustainability. So we've talked about how gender equality is related to health and how education is related to poverty. So I want to talk about emissions from transport, because that's one of the big things in the food industry. In addition to biodiversity loss and land loss, transporting these things. When you have a product that you're growing in South America, many times you ship it to China for it to be prepared and then to the US, and the transport of these things create a lot of carbon emissions. Is this something that you think about at all in your work with transporting insects?
Oh, yeah. Ironically, sometimes too, you're paying more for us shipping them in than the cost of the insects. Very definitely, because first of all, I've always believed in the buy local attitude to begin with, but insects can be grown in small batches and they can be grown, you know, if you wanted to get into a commercial business, you could probably grow enough in your garage as long as you have the market. And again, you almost have to educate your market before you have a market, but you could grow a substantial amount in a small area. Again, they stack on top of each other. You can go bin after bin. So insects are perfect for that because you can have all different types of insects. And I should also mention another side of this, and you're probably going to talk to somebody else about this, but the black soldier fly larva, you know about that? Should I
mention it? Don't. Go for it. Tell us all about it.
So this is insects as feed. We just talked about insects as food. But black soldier fly larvae are being raised, and believe it or not, up until just a year ago or around a year ago, it was illegal to feed insects to fish that were being commercially sold. So here's the natural food of fish, and we're saying, no, you have to use fish feed. But there's a problem with fish feed because we're running out of mackerel. We're running out of the sardines and the herring and the feeder fish that, you know, the fishermen are using. And so something that can replace that is these black soldier fly larvae. And the larvae are, you know, they look like big maggots. But they live off of food waste. So these companies can go around to restaurants and grocery stores and get their food waste that would otherwise be going into the dump and turning into greenhouse gases. And they can use that as food. And that food turns into the food for, right now, again, the only thing it's legal for is salmonoids or salmon and trout. But it's, you know, again, a natural process and totally sustainable. And again, it's localized. You're taking local food waste, you're turning into feed for trout and salmon that are going to end up back in your grocery store as fresh caught local fish. You know?
Yeah, it's completely circular. That's
really
interesting.
Yeah, it's beautiful. In fact, sometimes I wonder if I should have gone that direction instead of the food direction.
Yeah, I was reading an article that there's a company in China that breeds cockroaches that can actually eat through single-use plastic. And then when they eat through plastic and food waste, then the cockroaches die and then they're ground up and they're used as food for pigs. And then we eat the pigs and then the pigs die and then the cockroaches again will eat through the organic waste and the single-use plastic. That was just incredible to me. How can you breed an insect to eat through plastic?
Mealworms do the same thing. I mean, you know, you can get those at Petco. It's kind of amazing. You know, I believe right now it's the renaissance of insects, and it's at a good time because it's also the apocalypse of insects. I mean, I don't know if you know about the famous German study from a year or so ago. It was a 30 or 40 year study on flying insects in Germany. And we only have 25 to 30% of the flying insects we had 30 years ago. That many have been dying off. If you remember 20 years ago, driving down the road, if you went on a long trip, you had to clean your windshield off every time you got gas. You don't do that anymore. I mean, I haven't cleaned my windshield off because of bugs in a long time, and I live in Maine. You have bugs. Yeah, so there's a big problem, and I believe that the causation is obvious, and, you know, it's pesticides. We're poisoning the earth. We're just pouring poison all over our fields. You know, I remember my neighbor outside with his little poison bottle every Saturday hitting every single weed in his, you know, so that poison goes somewhere. And they think it just affects a certain kind of this or that, but we don't know what it affects and we're finding out, you know. And so half to three quarters of the insects are disappearing. That's a major, major problem.
Yeah. So everyone I talk to on this podcast has such creative and innovative ideas for moving us in a more sustainable direction. Would you ever consider running for any form of political office to kind of get these policies changed and these ideas out there more?
Not sure about the office itself, but I would like to get more involved in a sense. You know, something we all think about and it's needed. I mean, you know, we need to get the attention, but also, like I said, isn't it amazing that insects weren't allowed as a food for trout and salmon for years and years and years?
Yeah.
So, yeah, some of these things are just silly. I mean, it's just because, ooh, ick, an insect. And so that's our pervasive attitude towards all insects.
Well, thank you so much for talking to us today. I am definitely going to start with cricket powder and then probably move on to something more adventurous. But
well, that's great.
Really appreciate your time.
Oh, sure. I appreciate the opportunity. So thanks a lot, Adam.
Thanks so much for listening. If you want to support this podcast, please visit sustainablepartnersinc.org/donate. Also, follow us on Instagram at sustainable.partners. Today's episode was engineered by Drew Alsbrook, produced and edited by Shelby Kaufman, and executive produced by Sustainable Partners, Inc. I'm your host, Adam Mett, and thanks for listening to Planet Reimagined.